Peter R. Breggin, M.D., is called the conscience of psychiatry for his many decades of successful reform efforts. His scientific and educational work provide the foundation for modern criticism of drugs and ECT and lead the way in promoting more caring and effective therapies. His books include Talking Back to Prozac, Toxic Psychiatry, Medication Madness, Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, and now, Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety, Understanding and Overcoming Negative Emotions. Welcome to the Dr. Peter Breggin Hour.
Hello, my great audience, wonderful folks, growing numbers of you, cutting edge of reform, some of the best folks in the world. It's a great pleasure again, great honor again, to once a week be on the line with you, and then to know that many more, many, many more, will be downloading the podcast. I realize I'm feeling a little somber as I begin the show because we have once again had a horrific mass shooting in the United States of America, this time in a Texas church. These things, in this case, the murderer, when he stepped outside, was actually shot by an armed citizen, which is we have not had happen very many times in these situations. And it was basically handled, it was handled without the intervention of the police, who got there after he had driven off and had died of gunshot wounds and maybe a self-inflicted wound. But once again, this individual has had exposure to psychiatry. We don't know that he was on any psychiatric drugs, but he had beat up his wife and cracked his child's skull. And when he was in the Air Force, and they had hospitalized him, almost certainly it was involuntarily, and he then ran away, and he ended up going to prison after a court-martial and then being discharged. And the Air Force neglected to file with the FBI the required information that he should, that would have said that he had been convicted of a crime, a felony violence crime, and also domestic violence. Both of those are code words that are supposed to be sent to the FBI, and the Air Force never did, or he would never have gotten a gun, at least not legally been able to get any kind of a gun, even guns that don't require a license. But the involvement with psychiatry is persistent. Even when people aren't on drugs, they've been on them. Or like Cho from Virginia Tech, he was involuntarily hospitalized. I mean, one thing it indicates, of course, is that these people appear to other people at times to be disturbed, that they get in trouble with institutions sometimes. Mostly, though, they're pretty shy and quiet people who stay out of trouble, these perpetrators of horrendous violence. The one thing it does demonstrate is that psychiatry is doing absolutely no good whatsoever in preventing any of these things from happening. And it may be worsening them in a couple of ways, and my guest today might be interested in commenting on this somewhere along the way, that the psychiatric encounters make these people feel more humiliated, especially the involuntary ones, more humiliated, more angry, more frustrated, more helpless, more resentful, more humiliated. Humiliation is like the basic emotion, I think, that drives these murders. The feeling of, you know, I can't take it anymore. You're not going to get away with it anymore. I'm going to get even. I'm going to be powerful. You think I'm nothing. I'm big. I'm strong. And so on and so forth. It's a public event closely associated with shame, having the big final say in a huge public event. But, you know, psychiatry is the drugs clearly cause violence, but that they get often. We don't know this man was on any drugs at the time, but he was in the past. Do the drugs being taken a year or two earlier contribute to violence? I don't know. But I do think the humiliating contacts with psychiatry probably do as well contribute ultimately to violence. Well, just meandering thoughts of a man who's dismayed and is searching for ways to talk about this dreadful issue that may get worse and worse with more and more copycats, driven not so much by ideology often now as by their personal rage or outrage or vendettas. It was said that his the shooter in Texas church, that his mother-in-law and her family attended this church, although they weren't there. Well, just some thoughts to think about. Now, my guest today is one of the most brilliant and devoted and dedicated people in the field of mental health reform or anti-psychiatry, as she happily labels it. Bonnie Burstow, are you there in Toronto?
I surely am, Peter.
Oh, you good. You sound good too, Bonnie. You sound good. Bonnie is on the faculty at the University of Toronto, and she describes herself as an anti-psychiatry activist. She writes about language. She's very interested in institutional forces and resistance to them and social change. One of her most recent books on my shelf, it's a really good book. It's a documented academic book, Psychiatry and the Business of Madness. But she's, by the way, Bonnie's been on the show twice before in my somewhat lengthy now exposure, and your exposure to me is over, I don't know, 350 shows or so. Bonnie's been on twice. I mean, but Bonnie should, it's not a fair representation at all of her importance to me or to the movement. What's so unique about Bonnie, which is kind of unique about me too, and kind of sets us apart from a lot of other people, is that we're both scholars. We're both very academic in our thinking, and we're both activists. And we're activists in different ways, but we're both activists. We have a lot in common around that. And we're both novelists. We both write fiction. I don't know if I even told Bonnie. I had two published novels in the early 70s.
I know that.
And I stopped writing novels, A, because I'm not sure I ever knew how I wanted to do it, but also because I just got so caught up in the necessity of making a scientific argument that was counter to all the abusive, irrational, disgraceful things going on in my profession. Bonnie has a new novel out. It's fresh out, The Other Mrs. Smith, and it's a novel about psychiatry and electroshock and other things, and I'll let Bonnie tell you about that. Bonnie, I hadn't prepared you for that question because I didn't know it was going to come up until I sat in front of the mic and felt sad and realized,
yeah.
Oh, God, another one of those shootings, and I should address it here. I got to address it to 6 million people on George Norrie's Coast to Coast, North America and Canada, you know, the evening it happened, where I'm his resident psychiatrist. But you know, Bonnie, so many of them have exposure to psychiatry. And
not
and
just
some
so
of
many, the overwhelming majority of them.
Yes,
we need to be honest here. Psychiatry is not the answer to violence. Psychiatry causes the violence. And if we don't take that seriously, we will have more shootings, we will have more killings, and the answer will be to give more of the very thing that's creating a huge part of the problem. I'm not suggesting it's the only part of the problem, but psychiatry is a factor here that is huge. Huge numbers of these people are on psychiatric drugs. Huge people, number of these people had psychiatry invading their lives and the humiliation and trauma that that means. Other things I think are involved is we haven't come to terms with patriarchy. It is mainly men that shoot people. And we certainly haven't come to terms with the gun culture in the United States. So yeah. I think, but is psychiatry an integral part of all this? It is a huge part of all this. You disorder people's brains and you humiliate them. And of course, you know, you're walking around with a time bomb.
Yeah, you know, and another part of the that I don't talk much about, most of us don't talk enough about, is that psychiatry too is viewed by people as the main resort when you're feeling very,
That's
very
right.
upset. And a lot of these people turn to psychiatry when they could have turned to something far more useful, either nothing or counseling or therapy or religion or reading some books about how to live your life. But psychiatry is like this black hole that sucks people up, and then they don't get any other help. They get burned. They don't go anywhere else.
Absolutely. If you know, and they're doing exactly, and when they choose it themselves, they're doing exactly what society tells them to choose. You're in trouble, see a psychiatrist. But you couldn't have worse advice. If you're in trouble, you're going to be in much worse trouble shortly. If you go
in general. Bonnie and I, we agree that going to a psychiatrist, and I am one, just want to remind you, if any of you don't know that out there, that going to a psychiatrist nowadays is just about the most dangerous thing you can do. And sending your child to a psychiatrist is a prescription for a horrendous tragedy.
Yeah. I actually had an article come out a few months ago in a Referee Journal article coming out in Ethical Psychology and Psychiatry, called The Psychiatric Drugging of Children as Youth as a Form of Child Abuse - Not a Radical Proposition. And it isn't a radical proposition. If you see what it does to the brains, never mind the psyche of the children, it meets all the criteria of child abuse.
Well, you know, Bonnie, I've been saying that for years, and I had a confrontation. I was invited to address all the research heads at NIH and NIMH on one occasion, kind of a big room and a huge U table. And one of them said, well, don't you think you're insulting America's parents when you say that psychiatric drugs are a form of child abuse? And I looked at him. I said, I've never said that the parents are the abuser. You folks here in this room are the abusers with your research and your clinical work pushing
exactly.
these drugs on people.
The parents
Bonnie,
are one of the victims.
Send me the article, Bonnie.
I thought I had, but I can send it to you again.
No, I don't think so. And you know, I had one out last year calling it child abuse and calling for a halt on giving these drugs to kids. I'm sorry, Bonnie, go ahead.
This came out a couple of months ago. But I'll send it to you again for sure.
Okay, thank you. So probably we've said enough about this particular subject. Let's talk about your novel and why you wrote it and what it is about.
I've been one of the people doing research into electroshock, meta-research, research on the research, all of that. And, you know, we are in a strange situation where we've proven our case 100 times over that this is brain damaging, that this causes huge memory loss, that this destroys people's lives, and nothing has changed. People still get it, and it's still growing. It's still growing in an industry just like it always has since 1939. And we've done activism, and that hasn't. Now, all those things may be necessary, but what I felt is they were insufficient because we are not winning this fight. And so one of the things I thought is people don't read accounts of people's lives and how it ruins their lives. And very few people read the science of electroshock. But people do read fiction. People like fiction. And if we can stir up public outrage through the fiction about electroshock, that could be the way to go. That's how I came to write this novel. So I told Carla McKaig about it. But I was thinking of Carla McKaig's a shock survivor, now dead. And she said, oh, for God's sake, Bonnie, write the novel. You're the one who can do it, and we need you to write this novel. It was the hardest thing I have ever written. I wrote another novel earlier of an electroshock survivors called The House in Lippincott, and it was a piece of cake compared to this novel, even though you think it was more traumatic because it was a family of Holocaust survivors. It wasn't close to as traumatic as the stuff gotten into in this novel. about a shock survivor. Because shock survivors are dealing with brain damage. They're dealing with isolation. They don't have a community to support them. They're damaged, and they're by themselves with everyone seeing what's been done to them as help. So really looking at what it does to someone's life. I decided to narrate the novel in the first person, which means I had to get into the head of a shock survivor. And I had to stay in the head. I had to tell the story as only she could tell it with all that memory loss. And she can't tell the story well in any easy way because she has memory loss. She doesn't know whole years of her life. And sticking with that, it was driving me crazy because I could tell the story she couldn't. And yet I had made this gambit to do it this way. And I was about to say, after 2.5 years, I can't write this novel. And then I said, I really want to get my life back. And the one way I can get my life back is starting writing this novel. And then it hit me like a thunderbolt. Yes, I can say that, but the shock survivor can't ask for their life back. They can't get it back. And if they can't get it back, I have to continue with this novel. And then I found that all the things getting in my way took me deeper and deeper into the psyche where I could really tell the story. So that's how the novel came to be written. It was, I've written many books in my life, but this one I began 9 years ago. It took 9 years to bring it to fruition.
Wow, that is really amazing. And thank you for sharing that. Amazing description of what you've gone through, Bonnie. I deeply identify with it. And you said it so very well. Would you honor us and read us a section of the novel?
I would be delighted to. So I'm going to read you a section from very early in the novel. And before we get to the first-person narration where she introduces us, we have a whole section where it's somebody else. It's a third-person narration, and we're following a man called Gerald around. And Gerald has been cleaning Naomi's house, is the person who ends up the first-person narrator by the time we get to the next section of the novel. And as he's cleaning her house, he discovers that her binders are out of place in her bookshelf. And he knows that it will terribly confuse her. And so he does two things. One, he calls up his little son and says, did you play around with her binders and put them out of place? Because his son's mischievous, and that often happens. And his son admits to it, and then he continues putting the binders back in place. And at some point, he brings out one of the binders and starts to read it. So what I'm going to do as I'm reading this to you is I'm going to go tap, tap, tap to tell you that he's beginning reading from the binders. And then there's different sections of the binders, and between the sections, I'll say tap, just one tap, so you'll know he's gone to a new section. And then I'll do tap, 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 tap again to end it, and then you'll hear Gerald's thoughts as he's thinking about what he's just read. So if you think you're hearing, if you think you're hearing confusion here, you're hearing something like confusion in poetry, but there's something about poetry that you can understand if you try to follow it like poetry. If you think you're hearing, if you think you're hearing 1960s and 70s international movies, you are, and they are getting confused. And if you think you're hearing something about electroshock, you surely are. So let me begin the reading. Alone once again with the binders, Gerald adjusted his collar, then began arranging them back in order. Black binder number one on the far left, then black binder number two, then a space for black binder number three, then the three red binders, the yellow binders, then the green, then the orange. Good, he told himself, mission accomplished. No, mission not yet accomplished. He turned around and approached black binder number three, picked it up, and stared at it sadly. Taped to the front cover was an index card which read, quote, memory/thoughts, October 2nd, 1971 to January 29th, 1973, unquote. Gerald nodded with recognition as he took on those words, then began flipping through the pages. Well, it was over a 4-inch binder. They could easily have accommodated over 200 pages. He didn't have long to flip. Her precious few had been inserted. Realizing how likely it was that anything new had been added, he closed the binder and started to slip it back into place. Something, however, drew him back. despite the fact he knew everything inside that binder more or less by heart, he had typed a fair part of it for Naomi and pored over it with many a sundry morning over crumpets and tea. Something always drew him back to Black Binder number 3. And so it is, Gerald took a break from his labor, pulled out the binder again, sat down in a chair, and began to read. Well, the binder held almost a year and a half of Naomi's memories, and so might reasonably be expected to cover many items, great and small. This, only this, is what Gerald found. Okay. Tap, tap. Pound, pound, pound. Adonai, Mary, Mother of God, Buddha, Ishtar, Inanna, Allah, anyone with ears that receive and a heart that quickens, make it stop. Pound, pound, pound. I swear on the Holy Torah. I swear on the Blessed Cross. I swear on the winds that lift up and the rivers that tumble from the Creator's bountiful lips. Do this and I will do anything. Do this, and lo, I will walk through the rest of my days humbly revering thy name. I will set up a table for thee in the presence of mine enemies. Night and day I will sing hallelujah, my knees against the earth, my eyes lowered, my hands brought together in prayer. I will press the horn of a ram to my grateful lips and issue a call to all corners of the earth, and the sweet young children, innocence dripping from their milky breath, will come running, running, running toward the sea, and we will all join hands and ascend the glorious orchard. Then we will gather together in the new Jerusalem and sing hymns in thy praise. But please, I beseech thee, make it stop. Make it stop. Tap. Pound, pound, pound. Where is that room where pain is born? A glimmer of someone hovering, like a headshot taken from a blow. Could it mean... No, no, don't want it. Don't do it, please. Not another one. Tap. Pound, pound, pound. Hem, hem, hammer. Now I'm getting somewhere. That's what I'm feeling, the relentless blow of a hammer. A hammer is smashing my head into smithereens, but not from the outside. I remember there were these lights, sizzling lights. Then there was a 3 count, or was it a 10 count? Then later, possibly centuries later, this hammer began striking again and again. Tap. Into the room, the wheels go. Squeak, squeak, squeak. Lightly, lightly, lights, lights, action. An eerie smell in the air, as if a tin plate had been accidentally left on a red-hot burner. Bloated bodies dressed in white floating over me. Something cold and sticky on my temples. Something rubbery in my mouth. A band pressing it around my legs. Uncomfortable. Uncomfortable. Straps wrapped around my legs, shoulders, torso. Just relax. This won't hurt a bit, said a voice as a needle punctures my arm. Come on now. Stop fighting us. There's nothing to be scared of. Count backward from 10 and you'll be fine. 10, 9, 8. Oh, my God, can't move a muscle, no way to breathe. How could they not know? Tap. A chilly morning somewhere in a distant galaxy, freezing toes peeping out of a meager gown, inching their way down the bare concrete floor, the sound of a fork clinking against a plate, the unmistakable scent of freshly brewed coffee. Hey, no breakfast for you today, Naomi, and don't forget to take your hair clips up, out. How come I'm getting nothing? Yes, yes, I've been here before. Who knows in what year, lifetime, incarnation, they'll be prepping me again soon, and soon mind, body, and that mysterious thing they call a soul will get sucked into this vacuum, and I'll be back in the fog. Tap. Pound, pound, pound. After this jackass of a schoolmaster picked on me, after I was caught trying to return the Underwood typewriter I had foolishly stolen, after 400 blows and more, I escaped from the performatory and ran for miles, my boorish arms swinging nimbly at my side, just like a professional athlete. Faster, 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 till I found myself at sea and stood there staring silently out into the waters, my head lowered, realizing there was nowhere to go. Tap. My eyes are swollen. I am flat on my back. I glance to the side, hoping to get my bearings. I can't make out much, but it's clear that I'm lying on something that resembles a stretcher. To one side, through a doorway with no door, is a room with a scattering of people milling about. I can hear someone or something crying in that other room, can make out giggling. A tale fit for winter is being told in a lisping, mellow voice. There is a wall on the other side of me. Nothing on the wall indicates where I am. What country, city, town is this? And what manner of people are meeting in that other room? Tap. Eyes peer at me, then quickly look away, because they are afraid, because they sense the humiliation, because they know not what else to do. Stretchers in front of me, stretchers behind me, some poor soul being dragged where none of us want to go. Who would have thought that a single shriek could fill the universe? Tap. Everyone has a name, an identity, and a past. And if everyone else has, so must I. What am I called? And why is everything always such a blur? And where is she? Where? Pound, tap. Pound, pound, pound. I am a teenage boy who stole a typewriter. Maybe, maybe not. But if I'm not a teenage boy who stole a typewriter, who am I? Perhaps the silent Mrs. Vogler. But if I am the silent Mrs. Vogler, where is Alma, my sister? And why are there so many people milling about when Sister Alma and I are supposed to be cloistered together in a cabin for the summer, just the two of us? If I could just catch a break, maybe I could. If I could just stop that infernal tap. Pound, pound, pound. What am I? I am a totally blank wall. Tap, tap. All the while that Gerald was reading, his face was calm, his gaze steady. Now the time was when he would have shaken his head in dismay, when he would have objected that the woman had never been crazy and cried out, so why? But not today. He simply took each passage one by one, scrutinizing, repeating the odd word aloud, pausing to consider. Once he came to the end, he pulled a cornpipe from his side pocket, then a tobacco pouch. The sweet odor of overripe apple instantly greeted his nostrils as he lifted the flap. He sniffed it, nodded, filled the pipe, tapped down on the pack on the tobacco, then added some more. Then he just sat there, sucking on the unlit pipe, his eyes keen, his heart determined. He was proud of what Naomi had accomplished and was intent on doing whatever he could to help her accomplish more. But it wasn't this that made Gerald's eyes sharpen. There was something of monumental importance in this binder, not on the surface so much, but tucked away. Something in the words or underneath the words. Something beyond the obvious, beyond the anguish, the damage, the terror, the sheer stupidity of it all. And maybe not today. Maybe not tomorrow, but sure as his name was Gerald Smith, sooner or later he was going to find it. Okay, Peter, that's the first. That's one of the very.
Oh, that's wonderful. That is wonderful. Thank you. Thank you.
It's an interesting novel.
Yeah, it's very, very interesting, and you really create that sense of disaster and tragedy and fragmentation that the people must experience. And I think one of the hard things must be about writing like that is to just be capturing the horror of it all.
That's what I try to do, and I try to capture it in all. Now, as we go through the novel, I also capture the incredible difficulty it took and efforts it took and ingeniousness it took to get back any of her life, you know, given the amount of damage.
Yeah.
And so I wanted to show both things. And, it's a 448-page novel, so you go on a real journey with this person.
I think it's wonderfully written and wonderfully read. Wonderfully read. Thank you.
I used to teach theater. You don't know that about me.
I could hear that. Yes, yes. God bless you.
I used to teach dramatic literature, and I used to teach silent film. My area was originally English literature and film studies. And then, of course, I'm a person with a social interest in research and with a social science interest. And so I went from there into teaching social work and teaching other things, right?
Yeah. Well, Bonnie, we have one of the highest at this point in the day of my radio show. This is a very high number. So people liked it. People responded to it. And that's good.
I'm asking people to get a copy of this novel and read it. I prefer people getting a copy at libraries if they can, because I'm not into people paying money. But one way or another, I'm hoping people are reading it, because I think you'll understand something about electroshock and understand what happens to people in these institutions in a way you've not understood it before. And I think you're going to want to become active and do something. And I'm asking people to read it, and I'm also asking people, I'm trying to create an army out there. Christmas is coming. I'm not Christian, but I am going to ask people, see if you can give this novel as a Christmas present to a few people. Let's get it out there into people's hands, because the average person knows nothing about electroshock and knows nothing about what our government is sponsoring and doing to people.
The book is The Other Mrs. Smith. Yes. What it reminds me of, Bonnie, since you're from Toronto especially, folks, the federal government, the CIA, actually supported an electroshock program at McGill.
Ellen Memorial.
Right? Wasn't it?
Yeah, Ellen Memorial Institute. It was more than an electroshock program. It was electroshock plus drugging and plus people keeping people unconscious almost all the day for day after day after day. Well, they wiped out all the memories with ECT and implanted new memories. And so these tapes played whenever they weren't getting shock of the new memories they wanted to implant in this brain that they had just driven memories out. And just give you an example of one of the tapes, it said over and over again, you are a bad mother, you are a bad wife. This was a phenomenal thing paid for by the CIA and the Canadian government. Cameron got a huge number of awards for his research.
Yeah, the psychiatrist's name, folks, Cameron. He was actually president of the American Psychiatric Association.
He was also president of the World Psychiatric Association.
Yeah, this was a very powerful man. This is McGill is, a very advanced medical center, university, and all of that. And it's kind of hard to believe that this goes on, but it goes on. And I stopped some lobotomy programs that were going on in Boston that were funded by the Justice Department in their experimental division. Used to be called LEAA.
Gosh. The irony of Cameron is he's one of the people who sat on talking about what should be done to the people at Nuremberg, and here he was doing every bit of outlandish experiments and getting money for it from the government. Every bit of human rights violations.
Did you think about trying to get into the head of a shock doctor talking about nightmares and terrifying work?
I think there's a gender division of the work that saves doctors from seeing what they do. So they shock them, and then the women nurses take care of the shocked patients.
Yeah.
The gendered work spares them from seeing the enormous damage that they create.
Yes. Well, in California, they had passed legislation that shock doctors had to report any persisting memory loss. These are the guys who actually administer it.
Yeah.
Had to report any existing memory loss a certain period of time afterward. So they actually, folks, stopped following up their patients in California so they would never have to report any persistent memory loss.
Of course. Yeah,
I laugh because the memory loss so anxious is horrendous. And yeah, Bonnie, go ahead.
Because the memory loss is horrendous, and again, there's a gender difference. So, people remember one flew over the cuckoo's nest. They don't know that most shock victims are women, and they don't know that women are way more damaged than shock. But I, from the 80s onward, I was part of an organization or different organizations that helped hold hearings into shock. And I could see the difference. It was loud and clear. Men would talk certainly about damage, but they would have lost 4 months of their memory. They would have trouble going back to school in various ways. Women would have lost 8-9 years, and they didn't know who their child was. There was no comparison. There was no comparison between it. And nobody was writing about it, and no one was talking about it, but I could see it because we had people, we had dozens and dozens of people testifying. Nothing could be more obvious. And it wasn't until Sackheim that a scientific study actually said women incur more memory loss. And the memory loss is astounding. And you can't navigate your life when you can't remember things. You don't know how to go to, you don't know how to do things. You can't return to your job because you don't have those skills anymore, and you can't get them back because just as it eradicates old, new memories, it eradicates other skills you had before. And so people are left with having to figure out what to do with this life where so much has been stolen from them and they're not going to get it back. Right. But when you think that this is being done with by our government, that's why in early 2000s, I started writing articles calling electroshock state-sponsored violence against women.
And, of course, Medicare in our country pays for it, so it's state-sponsored. That's a direct state sponsorship, and it results in a very large percentage of people in the U.S., at least up until recently, have been women. Bonnie, you were telling me that there's some change in that going. I mean, elderly.
No,
women,
not in women. It's still 2 to 3 times as many women.
The elderly
is not as big a percentage as it was before. It's still a huge percentage. It's just that youth has now become not also a huge percentage. There was one point where almost no children were given electroshock. And so, however, and the leaders in this, God help us, are the UK, they are now declaring it the treatment of choice for autistic children. So now children are getting electroshock more.
Let me take a minute, Bonnie, and tell you a story about Great Britain in that regard. It just a few months ago, a very friendly, kind-seeming team of reform-minded people came from Great Britain to film me on the return of increasing number of people getting electroshock. They decided to do it, I think, on an American institution because I think they were afraid of jeopardizing the health of Brits if they did an expose on it there using a Brit. And and I could sense that this was going to be a whitewash. And though they were very cordial and pleasant, and I've never seen the film. I understand I'm in it. But there was a key moment in my office that was so important and so so important. And that was they had this film to show me of just how disturbed this young girl, I don't remember what she was, 10 or something, how disturbed this young girl was, maybe 12, that she had to be shocked. And to show me how disturbed they were, they showed me the video. The video is of a young woman trapped in a corner by 3 or 4 staff, none of whom have the faintest idea to relate to a frightened, upset, angry youngster, which is you back off, but were pushing themselves on her, even reaching out over a kind of a mattress thing where they were pushing her on the wall, against the wall, even reaching over it to take a little swipe at her, pushing her.
Unbelievable.
Battering her. And I said on camera, this is what goes on. Facilities that abuse people and don't know how to help them, whether it's adults or children, then end up shocking them as the ultimate abuse that stops everything in its tracks. This is child abuse. And Bonnie, the guy was stunned. He was so stunned. He had me say a little more from another angle and stunned again. And I said, I hope you're going to use this. And of course, he did not. What was clearly the most stunning thing he got out of the whole filming, he didn't use.
Isn't that something?
Awful. Just awful.
It's just awful. And on one level, they don't know what they're doing. And on another level, unfortunately, they do. You know, there is a level on which they unfortunately do know they're wreaking enormous damage. And if, you know, all of psychiatry is undefensible, let's be clear. But most psychiatrists do not administer shock. Why not, and why aren't they talking about it? And so I also have to say there's an incredible cowardice there, because the reason they're not administering it is they don't want to be responsible for something that even they are aware is enormously damaging.
Well, and the shock doctors, you know, they're very power-hungry, power-crazed people. It's like a rape. You know, I'm sure you'll agree with me. You see
Absolutely.
These guys shocking these women, and it looks like a rape. And, you know, you can wear a suit, maybe even a white coat, and yet get that, you know, do that to a woman. And God knows they're so violent that they retaliate with all their might against any of their colleagues who criticize them. So that's one way they hold this in place.
They really do retaliate. They if they're interns, they're going to lose their internship. If they're established psychiatrists, they will keep them away from where the money is. I mean, they really do retaliate, which means they're defending this territory at all expenses. But it is nonetheless true that even if you know as a human being that you might suffer something in your career from your colleagues retaliating against you, that doesn't mean you have a right not to speak about it and to be silent and let everything be okay, because everything is not okay. You know, one of the stories I told at the launch, and the person who I told it about was at the launch. He called me one day, a psychiatrist in Toronto, to tell me that one of his patients, the niece of one of his patients, had just signed for electroshock and was getting it tomorrow, and they asked him what did he think of shock, and he said, "Oh, I can't tell you that," and then he called me and said, "Will you speak to them?" And so I spoke to them, but I'm not a medical doctor, so it didn't. So she went the next day and got shocked. And what I was aware of is all he had to do, and the guy was past retirement age, is have the courage to say what he knows about shock, and we would have saved one person from this kind of damage. And that's true in cities all over the world. If the psychiatrists who don't give shock said what they knew, we would be able to get rid of this treatment.
Oh, there's no doubt about it. I think that people are more afraid of their losing their identity with their professional community than they are afraid of dying. I think that
they
same
are,
man might
and,
jump
and,
in
and
jump into a lake
ephemeral.
To save somebody.
Yeah, that exactly. And that stuff's, you know, unimportant in the end. Yes, it's nice to be thought well of by our colleagues. It's much more important to be part of creating a decent society where we are not maiming people, where we are not harming people, where we are not traumatizing people. And when we die, because we all are going to die, we'll feel much better of ourselves if all we can say is our colleagues were okay with us.
Yeah, that is pretty sad. But it is it's a lot of how folks think. I don't think many of the folks listening to this radio show are in that position. But if you find yourself stuck in that position, from my viewpoint, yeah, it is harder and it is more dangerous to do what Bonnie and I do. But, God, it makes for a good life. Don't you agree, Bonnie? You've been around not as long as me, I don't think. But
not as long as you, but I am going on 73, so I'm not young. And I'm very ill. But I have a mission in life, and my mission is around making this some kind of better, more just and more decent and more humane society and world. And that means taking on psychiatry. There's no way one can do this with psychiatry without taking on the institution of psychiatry.
Now, folks, Bonnie has also taken on the entire institution of the University of Toronto, along with the entire medical and psychiatric professions of Canada. And she's had some major accomplishments this year in regard to making antipsychiatry a legitimate scholarly pursuit. We don't have anything like that in the U.S., or I don't think Great Britain either. Where
or anywhere else in the world, actually.
No? So Bonnie has done something no one else in the world has accomplished. And I'd like, please tell us about it, Bonnie.
Well, I had intended, and it's still the case, and I spend very little of the money I earn. I put it away, and it's all willed to set up scholarship in the anti-psychiatry area. And then I suddenly got worried, if this materializes after I die, they'll do an absolutely terrible job of it, and it'll be the reverse of what I'm looking for. And so then I decided to endow a scholarship at U of T now, while I'm still alive. And there was a lot of opposition, needless to say, and there were people like Peter who assisted me in trying to get this through. And it took about a year to finally get the approval. Now, it was hard to turn it down because I'm a faculty member here, and I'm teaching in this area. So I'm endowing something I'm teaching in, and they're not spending a cent of their own money. The endowment is coming from me, and I'm matching everyone else's amount that everyone else put in. So there was hordes of opposition. Nonetheless, it did become real, and then people dragged their feet on it, but finally it became an established fact, and there will be the first awarding of this scholarship in May of this year. And, you know, and I've been getting letters from students all over the world saying, can they come and study at OASIS University of Toronto, where this is an acceptable area of scholarship and where there's even money for it and a possibility of money. So it's very exciting. And so that's been one of the things that took me a few years, but I finally got into place, and it's a good use of my money. I can't take it with me. It's a very good use of my money. Right now I'm in another fight. That's an academic fight.
Bonnie, before you go to the next thing, what is it actually called? Anti-psychiatry studies?
It's called the Bonnie Burke Scholarship in Anti-Psychiatry.
The Scholarship in Anti-Psychiatry. God.
Yeah. And I've been asked to head the first committee that decides who to award it to, and to find who to be on the committee. So I've asked, invited a number of people. We already have a committee who will look at the applications for the scholarship when people
fabulous.
Want to apply and see if they can get the award. So it's down there on the books. It's absolutely official.
All right. Well, what else? You were about to take us on another trip.
What else have I been taking on? I don't know if you have been following this, but universities throughout the world, and now University of Toronto is about to become the next university that does it, have been creating policies by which they can force students to take, quote, temporary leave, unquote, on the basis of mental illness. And I don't know if you know what it's like for a student to be tossed out like that. Besides, it's a total denial of their human rights. They go into an instant usually depression, trauma, humiliated, and they usually never return to school. And now what gave their life structure and meaning has just been robbed for them because it's mandatory. They have no say. They're being kicked out, essentially. So in countries around the world, this is happening at universities in countries around the world, and they're talking about it. Here's the name for it. And Peter, as a fellow Holocaust student, you would catch the reference very quickly. They're calling it unfit to study, getting rid of students who are unfit
to study.
Oh, God,
no.
And if you don't recognize, so anybody who knows anything about fascism will recognize a parallel between unfit to study and unfit to live. It is absolutely horrible, and about half the universities have such laws. They're in the process of trying to bring one in to University of Toronto, and it will be voted on in less than a month. So I'm now kind of getting the student body interested, getting other people who care about human rights interested to try to stop it. So that's my latest fight.
I never even heard about that.
Unfit to study. Can you imagine?
Unfit to study.
And, you know, and the statement I want to make is, you know what? Nobody is unfit to study.
Yeah. Next, they'll call them useless students instead of useless eaters or something like that.
So it's a growing phenomenon. And every week I get letters from students at universities all over the world telling me they've just been tossed out on unfit to study grounds. So it's one of the latest assaults, and it's in academia. So as an academic, it's my fight, right? So that's been my latest, and I'm just 3 weeks into this fight because it just hit the papers that this was happening, right?
You think you have any chance of winning?
Well, I'll tell you what I've accomplished in 4 days' work. I've gotten a whole bunch of people signing a petition denouncing it on various grounds, including human rights. I've gotten students who networked with other people and are calling a teach-in on this issue on the 16th of the month. We have something called the Ontario Public Interest Research Group, who is not academics but is a social movement group, who are taking this on and have formed a committee to look at what the horror that U of T is bringing in. So yes, I'm having some movement on this. I'm hoping to stop it. I'm hoping to let U of T know that there is going to be such opposition that they're not going to like the reputation of U of T if they go forward. And among the people who signed the petition is a judge who's certainly in a position to say whether or not this is a human rights violation.
Oh, that's marvelous, Bonnie.
So that's for the last 4 days of my life has been on this, plus teaching my classes, right? So unfortunately, psychiatry infringes on every area. It's now infringing on the universities, and it's really important. If you're in any university, find out if they have such rules in your university, because you might be able to have them declared unconstitutional. It's worth looking into. They're also going after social workers here. So the Ontario College of Social Workers and Social Service Workers has just passed an amendment to their policies whereby they can now require social workers on a yearly basis to say whether or not they have any mental illness which will stop them, because if they have, that could mean that they're not competent and they should be thrown out. And they have to sign something saying they're willing to be looked into and investigated by the college to see if they have any mental illness on a yearly basis.
Where is this and who's pushing this?
The Ontario College of Social Workers and Social Service Workers.
They've got to be insane. They're so stigmatizing their own clients. Yes.
Their own kind, and they're throwing them out. The nurses have done the same thing. Incidentally, this is happening to nurses too. And what is that called? That is called unfit to practice. So there's a common formula in all of this, and psychiatry is at the basis of it all.
Yeah. You know, and then it's so funny. Those
of
us who are critics said we're stigmatizing people. This is such horrible stigmatization.
It is terrible stigmatizing. And a lot of these are very good practitioners. So what? Some of their colleagues find them a bit strange. Who cares? Their clients like them.
Well, it's funny because a lot of very loved therapists have been people who, who admit to huge personal issues. That's why they get into doing therapy.
Yeah. Of course. If you have thought deeply about the anxiety you yourself have and the various ways in which you've dealt with it, you're interested in helping other people who are thinking about these things. So in fact, people who have had issues that have gotten to them and have dealt with them, as opposed to buried them, they're the most likely to go into such kinds of helping professions.
Yeah.
They're not who you want to drive out. They're who you want to advertise and get. Right?
Absolutely. In the old days, often people who went into psychiatry, you know, the first they'd go to medical school. I went to medical school in order to become a psychiatrist. But in my time, that's not what people usually did. They went to medical school. Then they had some stresses and strains and identity issues. They went for therapy and they thought, gee, this is helpful. This is helpful.
Right.
Maybe I'll become a psychiatrist. And they would become the 10% of psychiatrists who would do therapy. Now,
now
you don't have that 10%. The people
no,
who
you
are
don't
coming
have anybody.
In are these really power-hungry, lacking in empathy people who see a profession where you can drug and shock people. What, Bonnie, a lot of people listening are going to be saying, not a lot, not in my group, but some will be saying, I didn't even think shock treatment was going on. Now, we don't have good figures in the U.S. I think a comfortable estimate here is probably 250 or 300,000 people a year. I mean, do you have any estimates for U.S. or Canada?
I don't have any estimates, but what I can tell you is grown every single decade, not by leaps and bounds, slowly grown. But 200,000 is approximately what I've heard about from the States, yes.
And they Canada, probably get that number for me, because that's a number I mention a lot.
And those are, yeah, and it hangs over the head of psych survivors. You know, if they're, it's the thing they're threatened with. You don't behave, we'll give you electroshock. So there's a punitive aspect to this too that we need not to forget about. It is the horror that, just like lobotomy was once the horror that everyone was afraid of, and God help us, they're bringing back lobotomy in Montreal.
Yeah, I stopped the it numbers in Canada are, back you know, in the 70s things, in are, North America and a lot of Europe, and I guess they think I'm getting old. They'll start it all over again.
Yeah, God. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. You know, one of the because this is a novel that goes over 65 years, you get to see what people thought. And so when my heroine was shocked in the 70s, her mother said, "But I thought they'd abolished it years ago." And then 30 years later, she thought they'd abolished it, only to discover that she was wrong and they hadn't abolished it. And so looking at that phenomenon is, how is it people always think it was abolished? What is the shock industry doing to create both the belief it's been abolished and the belief it's new and effective? How do they keep both those myths going? So that's one of the things that actually gets looked at in the novel.
Well, I think part of the idea that people think it's abolished is just that it's so horrific they can't imagine it. And I think that's one of the reform problems we have in this fighting against shock treatment. And even when I go into court and talk about it, you know, people just can't bear it. They just don't want to believe it.
They can't bear it, but then they'll go to, oh, but it's new and improved. And so one of the most common questions I get is, it still as bad as it was at the turn of the century? It's not much fucking different than it was. What do you mean still as bad? It hasn't
really
changed.
Well, folks, it's actually worse, because when you sedate people during the treatment like we do now, and when you give them sleeping pills the night before like we do now, and when they're often on tranquilizers, you have to give a lot more shock to cause the convulsion.
That's correct.
It's
that's
more
correct.
Damaging.
So
why do you think
hurt.
It's oh, – two quick questions, or one quickie. We got about a minute or two left. Actually,
okay.
Why do you think that women are more damaged? I think it might be that that the skull of the female is generally thinner.
I think it's Spinner Sackheim whose 6-month study came up with women being damaged. His hypothesis is women have a lower seizure threshold. I don't know the answer to that. Both, either one could be true.
No, I think it's possibly that because you see the electricity, folks, goes through the skull. The skull's a resistor. The machine tries to compensate for that resistance, but maybe it can't. And maybe women end up getting doses for thicker skulls, or simply their skull just can't resist it as much as it can.
Yeah.
But men, by the way, get horribly damaged. Some of the worst damage I've
damaged,
seen.
They get horribly damaged, but it really isn't comparable. It really isn't comparable.
Oh, no. Bonnie, I just went through a shock trial 2 years ago of a man who was reduced practically to dementia.
Oh,
well, to dementia.
Have individuals.
All he could do was sit around and sing.
Yeah, you'll definitely have individuals. But, you know, I've done things with the preside over shock hearings that went for weeks. And you hear the pattern, they're very dissimilar. And you can't sit through that without noticing that you've heard a huge gender difference.
Well, I think that's very important. It's not being emphasized enough and discussed enough. Folks, we're about finishing here with Bonnie Burstow, Burstow, and her book, which just read amazingly if you just tuned in, is The Other Mrs. Smith. I have so much respect for you, Bonnie, and so many different aspects of who you are and what you do. And I hope you're going to be teaching some wonderful young students to stand up to authority, and in particular in our field. Thank you for being on the show, Bonnie.
And thank you for having me again, Peter. The respect is mutual. You're always one of the people I've had huge respect for.
Thanks. Thank you so much.
Okay.
Bye-bye, folks. I hope this was a moving time for you.